On election night, there's only one place to be, Fox News Channel. In this critical moment, with the balance of power at stake, this is the midterm election everybody is waiting for. Only Fox News Channel brings real insight, smart perspective, and the all-important results minute by minute. Every key race, every pivotal moment, as America decides, we're there every step of the way on election night. Stay with special coverage starting at 6 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel.
Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Bruce Hurwitz Presents, a half-hour live interview podcast brought to you by the Profitability Institute. I'm your host, Bruce Hurwitz. For information about this podcast and how to become a guest, please visit our website, brucehurwitzpresents.com. This program is a free service to the business community offered by Hurwitz Strategic Staffing. We hope you will consider us for all your recruiting and career counseling needs. You can find us at hsstaffing.com. Before I get to today's guest, I want to invite everyone to join me this Sunday at 5 p.m. when I will be interviewing Jean Bauer. We will be discussing how what you do in your free time may help you get a job. I am delighted to be joined today by Anil Milwani. Our topic is accounting and taxes for the real estate industry. Anil, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, Bruce.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Let's get started. Why don't you introduce yourself and tell the listeners a little about you?
Sure. My name is Anil Milwani. I'm a CPA and founder and president of 212 Tax and Accounting Services. We are based out of Midtown Manhattan, 370 Lexington Avenue, right one block south of Grand Central. And I'm also a Manhattan resident. I live on the Upper East Side with my wife and two daughters. So I think we're real New Yorkers. And, you know, I really, people ask me what I do for fun, what my passions are, my hobbies. I mean, as boring as it may sound, I started this firm 9 years ago. And I've developed a passion not only for taxes, but also just, you know, meeting with new clients, existing clients, and learning about their situations and not only finances, but other things. And just, you know, helping them really make the most out of taxes and all of their financial planning needs.
Now, our topic is accounting and taxes for the real estate industry. What is unique about the real estate industry?
So there are several things when it comes to real estate and taxes that are fairly unique. First, I just want to start by saying, just basic background. One of the reasons why real estate is one of the industries we focus on is because I have a very strong connection to it. My brother has been a commercial broker for several years here, also here in the city. My father eventually got into real estate investing, and that's kind of what he does now on a full-time basis between Florida and New York. I have a lot of family and friends, other high school friends, college friends, who have decided to make real estate their career. So I have a lot of strong connections to the industry, and that's kind of what made me want to focus on helping people in that industry. The unique things, the first thing that comes to mind, only because it's one of the most common ways of deferring taxes, which of course people love not to pay taxes, but second to that, deferring taxes to a later date. It's definitely something that people like to do. And the real estate industry has something called a 1031 exchange. And basically what that is in the fewest words describes that without trying, you know, putting people to sleep this afternoon, is if you sell a commercial property, something that's used for rental income, not your personal property, not your primary residence. If you sell a property that is that generates income basically for business use, and you use all of the proceeds within a certain amount of time to buy another commercial property, something that also generates income, you do not have to pay any tax on the gain on that sale. So real quick, rough example, you buy a property for $1 million, you sell it 5 years later for $2 million. You know, if you just do a regular sale and collect the $2 million, you're going to pay capital without not getting into complicated things like depreciation and things like that. You're going to pay capital gains tax on $1 million. So then if you don't want to pay tax on the $1 million, and more importantly, you don't need the cash right now, then you would identify certain properties within a certain time frame, a few months, and then as long as you close on one of those new properties and spend the whole $2 million within another few months, basically you don't pay any tax at all on that gain. But one of the main conditions of this whole process is you never touch the money. None of that $2 million ever went to your bank account. It's held by something called a 1031 intermediary. And as long as the money went from the person who bought your property to the intermediary to the person to then the seller of your new property, you're usually in the clear and there's no tax on that transaction. So that's one of the most unique things. So I know I got a little too detailed there, but
no, that's okay.
I figured you were going to ask me about it anyway, so I guess jumped the gun on that one.
That's all right. Anything else you want to point out?
I guess the other thing that comes to mind is that, you know, probably I usually say most. I hate to use the word all because there's always exceptions to things, but I think it really is all real estate brokers, commercial, residential, wherever you are in the country, maybe in the world. You're an independent contractor. You're not a W-2 employee. You're not salaried. There's no withholding on your taxes. So that means that you're going to be responsible for, you know, paying your own taxes, putting aside money, estimated payments, setting up your own retirement plan, getting your own health insurance, which is another reason why we focus on that industry, because generally independent contractors need more, you know, tax services, accounting services, need more tax planning than your average W-2 employee. So that seems to be pretty, flows across the board for the whole industry.
Thank you for that. Now, breaking news, we know that the tax bill passed the House. I want to get to that in the second half of our interview. For right now, one of the things that I don't think a lot of people realize is that the real estate industry is regulated to a great degree. You think of the financial services industry, health, of course, anything regarding healthcare, but real estate is also regulated. Talk to us about compliance issues as that relates to accounting and taxes.
Well, there's no, in terms of just accounting issues, not regulation, correct?
Correct.
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing that comes to mind is just keeping track of your books and records, whether you are an independent contractor or if you decide to incorporate, you become an S-Corp or an LLC, you know, you're self-reporting all of these numbers. So, and especially in real estate, you know, things like travel, meals, entertainment, things that the IRS sees a lot of gray areas on are common deductions. You know, obviously real estate people have to travel locally, and a lot of times for different conferences, or if they have an out-of-state deal or something, they have to travel across states, maybe internationally. So, and then of course, when it comes to not meals, entertainment, you know, and there's a lot of entertaining clients in this industry for sure. I know there's like a big every year at the end of May in Las Vegas, there's a big convention called ICSC. It's the International Council of Shopping Center Convention. But I think it goes way beyond shopping centers because most people I know in real estate, especially from New York, they attend this conference in Vegas. And you can imagine the meals and entertainment that go on there. Leave it at that. But so it's really – and keeping – and when it comes to deductions like travel, meals, and entertainment, the thing is usually a receipt or an invoice is not enough. You know, you have an accounting bill, a bill from Staples, a bill from your consultant, or a general office expense or business expense. You show them a receipt, an invoice, how you paid for it, they're usually going to move on. Now, when you show them a receipt for, you know, going to a Knicks game or going to Las Vegas or going to a steakhouse, they generally want more than that, right? They want to know who you had the meal with, who you went to the game with, why that's considered a business deduction, what was the profit motive there, what were you discussing, did you end up doing business out of it or not? You know, you don't have to necessarily generate revenue with that client who you went to the game with, but did you at least, was there a true profit motive in taking that client to the Knick game? Things like that, you need to keep a good log of, right? Because what I've seen a lot of times is that once you get the audit letter and once you, you know, prepare for the audit, you can always you can create the log at that time, right? You can go back through all your credit card statement and things like that. But let me tell you something. Most of the auditors know when it's been recreated. They're not stupid. And just by looking at the format of it, the notes on it, you know, the dates, times, whatever's on it, they pretty much tell if you kept it ongoing or if you just created it within the last week or so. So that's, I think, a very key thing, not only for real estate brokers, but anyone who's self-employed or has their own business, is try to keep a log as you go along, whether it's, you know, whether it's Excel, QuickBooks, there's plenty of apps out there. You know, just kind of keep it going, back it up, because, you know, you could get audited a year from now, you can get audited 3 years from now. So the more you prepare for it, the better, obviously the better off you'll be.
Now, for entertainment, I wasn't thinking of trips to Vegas. I was thinking of an open house where the real estate agent goes out and buys a platter of cookies.
Sure.
Now, that's pretty straightforward. There wouldn't be any issue with that, would there?
No, that's probably considered de minimis. The auditor, most auditors wouldn't even bat an eye at it. They just move along to something else.
Yeah. But the one that I'm really interested in is the travel. Because when I started my business, I went to a few seminars given by, I don't remember if they were current or former IRS agents, and they said that there were two red flags. The first was if you have someone who you are paying as a consultant, but they're really an employee. If they can tell by looking at what they're being paid, if it's something, to use a very technical term, which I'm sure you've heard in New York City, something ain't kosher. And that's the first flag. The second is the car. And they said you can't claim 100% of your car because you're going to be using some of the car for personal purposes. So, Anil, how do you work out the percentages? Because you're going from one open house to another. You're schlepping potential buyers around the city. And then you go and you have to go shopping.
Just keep a mileage log. Keep a log of destination to destination. I mean, as tedious as it sounds, you know, it doesn't sound like fun at all or exciting, but especially these days with all the apps available and the use of smartphones and iPhones and Androids, all that stuff, just keep a mileage log. Because at the end of the day, if they go through your mileage log, they're generally not going to go line by line. They're going to look at they're going to test it for reasonableness, right? So, like, they're going to look at your miles used the whole year and what percentage you say you use for business as opposed to personal. So if it's a reasonable percentage, they may not even look at the details. They're only going to look at it if they think you're abusing the privilege, you know, if you're maybe 70, 80, 90% for business. But then again, if it's true, it's true. Again, as long as you keep the log, you're probably going to be okay. And, of course, they're going to compare that log to the deals you made, you know, what area you cover, things like that, you know. I mean, in Manhattan itself, most of the time you're probably looking at subways and Ubers in terms of, you know, writing things off. So with a subway or an Uber, it's a little more straightforward than a car. But obviously, if you're doing it in other boroughs or suburban areas, it's going to be more car stuff, like you're saying. So the mileage log is the best way to go. And the other thing is, there is, if you are one of those people who have to have two cars, and you have another car for personal use, then obviously that'll help you justify a higher deduction, if not 100%, which I'm sure happens in the suburbs, you know, sometimes in terms of people having two cars. So that is that is a rare exception. That is, you know, probably something they would accept.
Okay. Now, let's just say that it works out that you spent 60% of your mileage on business. Does that mean you can charge 60% of gas, oil, maintenance to the business?
Correct. You can do 60% of all your car expenses. So the way it works with a car is that you either do the standard mileage deduction or you do the actual expense deduction. The main rule on that is that once you choose one of those, you have to keep it the same the life of that vehicle. Whether it's used or new, when you buy that vehicle to when you sell it or when your lease is up, you have to keep it the same every year until you get rid of the vehicle. So standard mileage is I think it's like it changes 1 or 2 cents a year. I think it's around 56 cents right now. They change it depending on the price of gas and inflation, things like that. So if you do standard mileage, you're not allowed to do any gas repairs, maintenance, no depreciation. You can still do parking and tolls no matter what. But if you don't do standard mileage, then, of course, you take the repairs, maintenance, the gas, depreciation, and then you times it by the percentage.
I did not know that. Thank you. Now,
I'm sorry, going back to you, the first part was about W-2 versus
1099. Yeah.
I just want to make a quick comment on that.
Sure.
Because, the IRS recognizes most of, like, it's not all brokers as 1099. If you're paying a sub-broker or a broker under you on your team, you're okay to pay them 1099 too, because that's how you're getting paid, and they're doing the same kind of work as you, which is considered independent sales work. The only exception I think that I've seen in the real estate industry is if you have a full-time administrative person or someone who's not primarily – not licensed to sell real estate or not doing sales, then yes, you should put them on a W-2, part-time or full-time. If they're under your control doing administrative work, they should probably be an employee.
Thank you for that. And well, before we go on, I'd like to just take a moment to talk about someone who I consider to be a mentor. I started doing podcasts about 8 years ago. I had my own show, and then I joined the Manhattan Chamber of Commerce. For 5 years, I hosted their podcast. The idea for that podcast came from Gil Efron, founder and CEO of the Profitability Institute. At first, demand to be on the show was not great, but Gil is a marketing whiz, and together we developed a new strategy, and from then on, the show was literally booked solid a year in advance. When I relaunched this podcast, I remembered what Gil had taught me, and sure enough, within 10 days of promoting the show, all of the slots for November, December, and January were fully booked. Gil now works with businesses throughout the U.S. The way he explains it is that every business, new or well-established, has a sales funnel or sales process. Sometimes those funnels get clogged. Gil created a process that connects the dots between marketing and the sales process, eliminates points of constraint, and brings about extraordinary marketing and sales outcomes. He wrote about it in his best-selling book, How to Close More Business in Less Time. You can learn about Gil and how he unclogs the sales funnel at profitabilityinstitute.com or call him at 813-489-9596. He's always happy to demo how he unclogs the sales funnel and brings about extraordinary marketing and sales outcomes. Feel free to tell him that I sent you. Anil, we were talking about compliance, but I'd like to bring up two other issues. First, financial operations. What do people in the real estate industry need to be aware of?
Sorry, can you clarify what you mean by financial operations?
Well, it was I'm just taking from the write-up that you sent in. You wrote, we have built real estate accounting services around the unique set of compliance, financial operations, and cash flow issues these businesses face. So what are those financial operations, unique set of issues to which you were referring?
Oh, yeah. I guess that, sorry about that. Yeah, that depends on, what, I guess, aspect of real estate you focus on. That's most of that is mainly for the investors and developers in terms of financing their deals, because obviously when most deals are financed one way or the other, whether it's from investors, debt or equity, or from a bank or other lending institution, or some now these days, these hard money lenders, or a combination of one or more of those. So, from the developers and the investors we work with, sometimes they involve us in, helping them apply for the bank financing, helping them present the deck to the investors or other hard money lenders. So, we that was just kind of us saying, well, we can also provide that service if needed. Not so much needed on the broker side, because you know if you're purely just a broker, generally it's just mainly dealing with your cash flow, making those estimated payments, looking at your quarterly P&L and seeing where things are on a quarterly basis, so you don't fall behind on taxes, don't fall behind on your estimated payments, trying to stay ahead of the game so you don't have a big bill when April 15th comes around. So I guess it depends on kind of what aspect of real estate you're in terms of how much you need us, if you need us, to what level of role we're going to play in that financial operation.
By the way, just out of curiosity, what's the difference between a broker and an agent?
Well, I think generally people start as – I mean, I think it's more or less two terms for the same thing. But people – there is like a sale – you become like a salesperson and you get sponsored by a broker, and then you eventually become a broker later on. So I think it's more the difference between broker and salesperson.
Okay. Now, you touched on cash flow. Is there anything you want to add?
No, not much on that. I mean, really what it is just, you know, like most other self-employed individuals, other business owners, just keeping, because it's a commission-based industry, right, where you can have, it's all, you're paid when a deal gets made. If no deals are made, you don't get paid. So it's really just kind of planning for your personal overhead, personal expenses, and also business, depending on the level of operation you're at. And just making sure that you can get through those, you know, there's those cushions, getting through those harder times and not falling behind, not only not falling behind your taxes, but not falling behind your own personal bills and personal expenses.
Thank you. Now, as I mentioned at the beginning of the show, the House of Representatives has passed the tax bill. Obviously, the Senate will pass theirs, and then they'll meet in conference, and the third and final draft will come up. So whatever we discuss right now is tentative, to say the least. What can you tell us about the bill that was passed today pertains to business in general and the real estate industry in particular?
So, you know, the real estate has been a major part of this bill because the things that they're going after, they're limiting the mortgage interest deduction. They're either deleting or limiting the real estate tax deduction. They are reducing the advantage for when you sell your primary home, the amount of gain that gets excluded. Again, different than 1031. This is on primary homes now. They're limiting that. They're making it harder to get that exclusion. Like now, the way it exists now, it's you have to live in that home 2 out of the last 5 years. They're going to make it 5 out of the last 7 years. And then again, the 1031 thing, that's the thing that's kind of unclear now, but one of these versions of the bill kind of is actually trying to reduce it or eliminate it. Now, they are coming up with another loophole with depreciation to offset that, but they definitely, you know, part of these Republicans or these people writing this bill are going after the 1031 like-kind exchange exclusion, which is a big thing, especially when it comes to these commercial bigger deals that are traded and, you know, several times a year, obviously. So real estate is definitely a major aspect of it. Now, the effect on the housing market, again, that's yet to be seen, just like the effect on creating jobs and the overall economy. No one can predict that. But, you know, I saw an interview of the CEO of Zillow, a big real estate website, was on CNBC like last week, and I actually posted it on my Facebook and LinkedIn because he had a good point. Like, according to him, who's one of the, you know, probably the most educated real estate people in the industry, in the country, he doesn't think that most housing markets, he doesn't think are going to be affected. He did say a market like New York, which has a lot of people, you know, higher mortgages because you have higher property values, higher real estate taxes, that could be one of the markets that may see more of an effect than certain other ones. But, again, it's really going to depend on what they actually agree on. And then, again, it's real estate. So it's a lot of supply and demand. You know, it could have no effect. I mean, depending on how supply and demand go and how the overall economy goes, the market could go up or down because of many other factors. So it's a little too early to tell, like you say, in terms of the effects of the bill on real estate.
What about the lowering of the tax brackets? from the
That's definitely one of those factors that could help the market, right? If people have more money in their pockets and more money for things like down payments and saving up to buy their own homes, to me, it's something that'll hopefully help the real estate market. So I think that's again what that Zillow CEO was saying. It's like there's so many things going on here that just because real estate deductions are definitely going to go down doesn't mean that the housing price is going to go down, because something like the brackets going down could help it. The way I see it in New York, though, because most of us are live or work or both around here, my guess would be that it's going to have some kind of negative effect. How much, I don't know. Because the other thing is they're also going after the state and local tax deduction. And we pay a lot of taxes to New York State and New York City. So by losing that deduction also, it's gonna be more of a negative effect on our bank accounts and less down payments being saved for. And maybe people will end up either just continuing their leases or looking for rental homes, because it's already so hard to save up for a down payment here anyway, that it's going to discourage people and keep them as renters for a longer period of time.
What I was getting at, and what I don't understand, and again, this is all tentative, is some people in real estate earn a great deal of money, obviously. Because
it can be a very lucrative industry.
Property
is
very lucrative. Now, if the tax bracket is lowered, most of these people, as you said, are either LLCs or S-corps. So, and that's both of them are pass-throughs.
Correct.
So,
yeah.
Wouldn't that, in the case of Manhattan, well, all of New York City, now I believe Brooklyn's more expensive than Manhattan. So all
in
of
some
New
areas,
York City,
for sure, yeah.
Wouldn't that significantly impact for good how much they're going to be paying in taxes?
You're saying reducing income taxes of New Yorkers?
Reducing the income tax, yeah. Because you're paying...
Right, that the bracket will go down, but then if certain deductions are being eliminated or reduced, that has a reverse effect, right? So...
I understand.
So it's yet to be seen how it affects. I mean, I guess I haven't, I don't know if anyone's run a model on on these New York taxpayers to see how that would affect it. But for the most part, most people think they're going to pay the same or maybe a little more. I don't think anyone thinks, most New Yorkers don't think they're going to pay any less. Or if anything,
I'm
a very little less. No one around here is getting a huge cut. That's the consensus.
I'm sure that models have been run by Republicans showing this will be a great savings, and models run by Democrats showing
they're running
that
it more on a national basis.
More.
Yeah,
yeah, and that's also true. I was going to say that New York City is unique, but Los Angeles would probably be similar, maybe Chicago.
Yeah, almost all of California, California, New York, and some other high-tech states. New Jersey and Connecticut aren't that different.
No.
Pennsylvania.
No, not at all. But then again, there are some, New York State, we say it's the city, Long Island, and upstate New York. So, we're a little bit prejudiced in a way. And
that city residents are losing that city tax deduction. So that 3-4% we pay to the city, that's no longer, that's a big thing for people in New York City.
Sure. And New York City is
over certain amounts of income.
Because
if you take the standard, it won't make a difference. But if you make, let's say, probably any over 200 or over, which around here is pretty common, you're gonna lose that itemized deduction for the state and city taxes.
Well, that's what makes New York City unique. This is the only city in the country, if not the world, that has its own income tax.
Yeah, there's a few others, but not many. Yeah.
Oh, okay. And what would this have to do with the, what's it called? the commercial rent tax, which I believe is from 96th Street and down only in Manhattan. Would this have any impact?
Not completely city regulated, so this bill has no effect on it.
Could they? So there wouldn't be any deduction of the federal taxes for what
they're
paying for
that. See, now that's purely a business deduction. I don't know if it's going to limit that because that's more of an LLC. My guess would be they're not going to touch that. It's still going to be a deduction. Because it's paid by it's only paid by people who pay more than like $250,000 a year in rent. Businesses, but you know, like you say, businesses that exist 96 feet or below who pay more than $250 in rent. So
exactly.
I don't think that's going to be, I think they're still going to allow them to deduct that as an expense. But I'm not totally sure about that, to be honest with you.
All right. Well, we can't be totally sure about anything because we don't know what's going to pass, if anything.
Yeah, true.
And one thing that I'm curious about, let me ask you. I was going to thank you, but before I do, the business of this postcard, if individuals can fill out their taxes on a postcard, what's that going to do to the accounting industry? I mean, as President Trump said, H&R Block will not be happy.
Yeah, I mean, H&R Block probably won't be happy. Along with many other, you know, all the other few national tax chains, possibly TurboTax, Intuit, you know, all these do-it-yourself softwares may also get hurt. It's and I've also, of course, thought about my own business. I mean, the way I see it, you know, we're as a full-service CPA firm, we're catering to people who. The way I see people have at least one or two things, if not three or four things, that make them uncomfortable doing it themselves, whether it's owning a home, investing in something, an international tax issue, multi-state issue. You know, there's several things that pop up that make it a little more complicated for some of the, you know, most importantly being self-employed. So the postcard thing, I almost think it would be, if it's like a, you know, they make these forms, right? Like the regular form is called a 1040. Then there's these other forms that's called a 1040A and a 1040EZ. We do hardly any of those. If you qualify for these, either a 1040A or a 1040EZ, which means, you know, you don't itemize, you know, you have no other schedules, no other types of income. It's simply W-2 income with no deductions, no itemizing. Then it almost is a postcard. I feel like I could, you know, we could probably make that into a postcard. It's already one or two pages anyway. There's no attachments, no schedules. So we're halfway there. It's just a matter of probably condensing it, changing the language a little bit, and you know, printing it on a postcard or hopefully maybe doing something online. I don't know if they want to deal with paper these days, you know. Maybe it's a simple website you log on to, answer 5, 6, 7 questions, scan something in or enter a few numbers and you're done. So it's probably just a simplified version. I mean, they already have this thing called IRS Free File and New York State Free File. So it's probably just modified versions of what's already out there, you know.
I was just thinking of some fool who fills out the physical postcard and just drops it in the mail and then doesn't understand how their identity got stolen.
Exactly. And that's the other thing, Bruce. They say they're very easy to say postcard this, postcard that, but –
yeah.
What about that increasing problem of identity theft? Like, so you're gonna have a postcard that says your social security number, your home address, and your income, and your date of birth, and your whole families, for that matter.
Yeah.
So, I mean, obviously it can't be a straight-up postcard. You know, it's going to be more like a letter that's mailed. And like you said, and these letters, even if it's a letter in an envelope, then people are going to rip these open, steal your identity. I mean, it's... You know, it's easier. It's much easier said than done, right? To keep it simple and keep it short. So, it's probably going to be something like a simplified website. You know, secure, simplified website. And then again, when's the last time the government tried to do something with a website? How'd that go?
Yeah,
right?
Thank you.
I'm not
going to
mention names
me.
Or words because I don't want
to
get political here. But I think we're a few years away from
website.
Going the postcard route.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's. Makes for a good photo op.
Exactly.
That's all. Now, you had mentioned 1040s, and people will understand in a moment why that's a good segue. to my thanking you, and before we close, asking you to tell people how to get in touch.
Sure. We're very lucky to have the phone number 212-475-1040. Again, that's 212-475-1040. We're open Monday to Friday all year round, and during tax season, January to April, we're open on Saturdays as well. So you can call us anytime during those hours, or of course leave a message. But of course, our website's the best way to do anything to get in touch with us. There's contact us forms, there's email links. There's a lot of not only blogs and written content, but a lot of videos now. So a lot of your tax questions will be answered with our videos. And then of course there's a consultation. We do charge $50 for the initial 30-minute consultation, but I'm happy to offer anyone who mentions that they listen to this podcast a free consultation. So that's all you have to do to come in and meet with us, whether it's on the phone or in person. We're happy to do that.
Thank you very much. You didn't say what the website is.
Oh, sorry, 212tax.com.
There you go.
Short, simple, and easy, 212tax.com.
There you go. Thank you very much, Anil. I really appreciate you coming on. You shared with us a wealth of information.
Thank you, Bruce. It's great being here.
And thanks again to Gil Efron of the Profitability Institute for their support. This is Bruce Hurwitz. Thank you for listening, and have a great day.
On election night, there's only one place to be, Fox News Channel. In this critical moment, with the balance of power at stake, this is the midterm election everybody is waiting for. Only Fox News Channel brings real insight, smart perspective, and the all-important results minute by minute. Every key race, every pivotal moment, as America decides, we're there every step of the way on election night. Stay with special coverage starting at 6 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel. On election night, there's only one place to be, Fox News Channel. In this critical moment, with the balance of power at stake, this is the midterm election everybody is waiting for. Only Fox News Channel brings real insight, smart perspective, and the all-important results minute by minute. Every key race, every pivotal moment, as America decides, we're there every step of the way on election night. Stay with special coverage starting at 6 p.m. Eastern on Fox News Channel.